Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Hello, listeners. I'm your squinty-eyed host of the day, Martin Kessler. And joining me is a man who wears both a belt and suspenders, Dave Eves. Hello, Dave.
Well, howdy. How are you today?
I'm fine. How do you do?
I'm good. It's early in the morning. I'm drinking my whiskey because we're talking Westerns.
Yes, we are. Great big one called Once Upon a Time in the West, directed by spaghetti Western maestro Sergio Leone. And it's a film that has a good, a bad, an ugly, but also a beauty. And really, the plot is just railroads and revenge. There's not much more to it than that. But Dave, do you like Once Upon a Time in the West?
I do. I saw it for the first time last night, actually, and I quite enjoyed it. It's been a while since I've seen any of Sergio Leone's films. I always liked them. I never really considered them to be like my favorite films ever made. But this one, it's good. I had a great time watching it. I think it's really expertly directed. And I think that it brings a lot of style to the table to kind of flesh out that, like you said, it's a very minimal story, but it's 3 hours long. But at no point do I ever feel bored during that 3 hours.
Right. Maybe one or two points I feel. But like one thing I really like is I think it's really like the first three scenes. They're mostly silent. They're these big, long stretches. And then you have the character introduced. It's a little bit like the beginning of The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, actually, where you have these sort of almost like little short films with each character being introduced. I really, really love the opening sequence where you have the three guys, two of them with dusters and Woody Strode, and they're waiting for someone to arrive and waiting for the train. And a lot of the film is sort of about waiting, I think, in a strange way. Like, I think Sergio Leone, I think a real master of maybe suspense, or I'm not sure how you describe it, actually, but like, you know, the fact that he can make three guys standing, like the climax of a film.
Yeah, he stretches it out very taut just through this use of close-ups and then wide shots and close-ups and then wide shots and then a insert shot of someone like with their hand near a gun, and suddenly like just somehow he's able to ratchet up that tension with very few elements.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then you have Charles Bronson open his mouth and say, "A few too many," or something like that. And I'm like, oh no. But I don't know. Could I say, like, I think maybe of the four lead actors, maybe two of them I think might be miscast. We can discuss this a little bit more, but a part of it is just coming off of those previous spaghetti Westerns, The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, and you kind of see those archetypes reappear in this film, but there's different actors playing them. Mm-hmm. To some extent, you can kind of say, oh, like the Charles Bronson, that's the Clint Eastwood character, and you can almost imagine how a lot of those lines would sound in Clint Eastwood's cadence.
And I definitely think that, that perhaps it was written with Clint Eastwood in mind, because he was originally asked to do it, I think, and he said no.
Right. I think I've heard like a little bit varying things about what happened exactly with their falling out, Sergio Leone and Clint Eastwood. But strangely, I think Charles Bronson was his first choice for the Fistful of Dollars way back when.
So really? No, came full circle there.
Yeah, get to go full circle. But it's definitely like a different screen presence and different delivery of his lines. And there's times when he's saying like, oh, inside the jackets there were men and inside the men there were bullets, and like you're like I know how that's supposed to sound. It doesn't quite have the same effect.
See, I feel like he works. I actually feel like, okay, I really like the cast in this one. I'm curious to see who you think the other person that is miscast is, but maybe it's just because I like Charles Bronson, and I think it's always interesting to see him in a role where he's not. I guess it's kind of like a Death Wish role where he's just killing people for revenge, which is what he became later known for.
Yeah. Yeah, this is sort of like the precursor to action movie Charles Bronson. I think Jason Robards is really fantastic.
Oh, yeah. No, I think he probably subtly steals the show.
He does. And like that's kind of like the Eli Walsh character from Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. But the way he plays it becomes something completely different. And he has such a great... added a great, great quality to him, I guess.
He has a weird charisma.
He does. You know, when he first shows up and you're not even sure what he's doing when he's talking, like, oh, does he play? But, like, I'm completely transfixed and I just want to see where it goes.
Mm-hmm. His character introduction is just great because you have him walking into a bar, everyone's, like, looking right at him, and suddenly he just lifts up his hands to take a drink and you see that he's shackled.
Yeah. Oh, that, like, that's such a great Leone reveal. Like, I think,
yeah.
I get, like, the visual storytelling's really fantastic. I think Sergio Leone, his father was, like, a famous silent film director.
Mm-hmm.
And he always has this, like, ability to, like, push the story forward visually.
Because no one's,
like,
talking.
In all his westerns, yeah, you know, you get this feeling that, like, if you can say a paragraph in a sentence, he'd do that. And if you can say a sentence in a word, he'd do that. And if you can say a word in a look, you know, he'd much rather do that. Mm. So it has that very stripped down.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, it's weird to call a film this, like, operatic minimalist, but I think it is in a way in just how bare bones it is and how all these, like, big Western sort of symbols or cliches kind of get boiled to their almost purest state and filter through a, you know, an Italian perspective and mm-hmm. sense of style, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what do you think of the Fonda's casting in the film?
Henry Fonda is, like, this absolute good in terms of most film history.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's juror number 8 in 12 Angry Men. I don't think you can get, like, more pure than that. And suddenly he's playing, like, the most despicable human being that you see in film. And for whatever reason, it works because he just seems nasty. I think him playing against type also, like, kind of disrupts your mental state and really improves just how that character is. Because, I mean, like, mm-hmm. I think when you're going into a film like this, because it does a great job of setting up characters as either being very morally ambiguous. Because, like, at the beginning, Charles Bronson, he shoots these three guys. You don't know who those three guys were. You assume they're bad. You assume that because Charles Bronson put 3 bullets in them, that they were that he's good. But you'd never really quite know. The only two people from the outset that you know are good or bad is Henry Fonda and Claudia Cardinale.
Right.
The reason you know Henry Fonda's bad is because he shoots a little kid. This little red-haired, innocent boy gets shot down by Henry Fonda.
Right. And this is weird, but, like, I like his sideburns. It just makes him look, like, rough enough that
yeah.
he fits into this world. Because, like, usually in, like, his other westerns, Fonda, like, he has a very kind of, like, clean image or...
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's sort of interesting. Like, you would think, okay, we're going to cast the good guy Fonda as the bad guy of the film. We want to sort of play into that good guy image. Like, I thought it would have been interesting if, like, maybe he was a white hat, like, kind of like the good guy who's kind of cleaned up his act. And then you find out that he has this, like, horrible history, and that's why Bronson's mm-hmm. out for revenge.
I think it'd be kind of interesting. I almost feel like with this, since when he was doing, like, his Man with No Name trilogy, like, Clint Eastwood wears dark colors in that, so that already kind of, like, reversed it. So he comes back here, he's reversing his own style, which is just back to normal again.
Mm-hmm. And that leaves us with the fourth lead, which is Claudia Cardinale, which... I don't know how much it's her performance and how much it's the way the character's written. Because, I don't know, she seems really kind of inconsistent to me.
Yeah.
Or... I don't, what did you think?
I think the character, I'll definitely say that there is probably some glaring issues in this film from a feminist perspective.
Sure.
Because some moments she's a really strong character, other times she's absolutely not. But
right.
She's certainly kind of a play. Let's talk strictly Western terms, because clearly this is a movie made by people, written by people that grew up watching American Westerns. And tried to make their own, not just tried, I think that they took the genre in new and different directions. That's interesting. But in Westerns, you traditionally have the virgin and the whore. And Claudia Cardinale somehow plays something in between. And I think because of the fact that they're playing on these traditional Western tropes and those two things don't always jive, she kind of has to flip-flop between tropes from scene to scene.
Right. And, like, instead of sort of making it feel like you're watching a more complex character, it makes it feel like a really kind of flimsy character, I think is sort of the effect it has instead.
And an exploited character as well.
Yeah.
Like there's a scene where Charles Bronson just rips her clothes for, I assume, no reason. Because I'm trying to, like, rationalize it.
Or she has that long scene with Fonda's character where they're sort of laying together, and he's like, oh, like, is there anything you wouldn't do to save your own skin? And there's something like really kind of like off, I think, about
I think that's where it becomes problematic. On,
I think the writing and maybe just how she's directed.
Because you would think that a more complex character, that would be a more traumatic scene. Instead, it kind of seems like she's okay with what's happening.
Yeah, yeah. well, I was wondering too, like, also, like, in relation to the characters, it's become kind of a standard line, like, oh, like, movies, the characters have to have an arc. What's their arc? And, like, people almost talk about it as if that's a rule. But one thing I kind of enjoy in general in the Leone Westerns is you always feel like it's not so much that these characters change over the course of the story, but that they're revealed. You understand who these people are just a little bit more by the end, and that they're, in their own way, maybe a little bit too hard boiled to have an arc.
Yeah,
but
they're not going to change. You're just going to figure out what their purpose was at the beginning.
Mm-hmm. They have a motivation, like that, you know, whether it's gold or revenge or a railroad something. That, you know, they're out to get what they want, and either they do or they don't. And like, there's very little change in who they are, if at all.
And that's like that gritty feel, and I think it's really hard to achieve, because otherwise, one, your movie could be really boring if your characters literally don't change at all. But I think it's giving them that somewhat interesting motivation, or even completely lack thereof. I don't know why Henry Fonda is such an evil person. He just is. He's just this
with an angel's voice.
Yeah. and the baby bluest eyes you've ever seen.
Yeah.
They just shine right through all the grit on his face and the sideburns.
They do.
I think part of the reason he looks like that, because there is a flashback.
Yep.
And during the flashback, he looks like somehow 50 years younger. And I was like, oh, did they cast like Peter Fonda? It's like, no, that's still Henry Fonda. They just took away the sideburns and he looks like he's 20. You add on the sideburns and he looks like he's 105.
It's true.
But those sideburns are great, because Henry Fonda's got a very narrow face, and Sergio Leone is famous for his close-ups. And just when you do the close-up of Henry Fonda, you got this little face in the middle and sideburns filling the complete rest of the image of the CinemaScope.
Yes. You're selling me on it. I buy it. Yeah.
I'm sure it was done very intentionally.
It's the widest screen. You got to fill it up somehow. Yeah. It's...
We need more sideburns in here. Cast more actors with wide faces. That's why we need Charles Bronson.
He's got a wide face.
He does. It's perfect for CinemaScope.
I can't tell if that's a compliment or not.
It's not a bad face.
No, it's not a bad face. It's he looks so like chiseled. Like you can see every like crack in his face. Like the way the film's lit too, like really brings up the skin texture. Like,
oh yeah.
Even like, you know, this is 1960s film. Like usually when you have the beautiful leading lady, like they. Most films would kind of, like, add the soft lighting, but, like, not here. Like, Claudia Cardinale, like, she still looks beautiful, but you can see, like, every, like, line in her face. Like, it's not the most flattering lighting for her.
You think where typically they'd add more powder to someone's face. It's like a spritzer with some more salt water for this shot.
Right. We were joking before, but, like, I really do think, like, everyone kind of has, like, the skin texture of, like, a honey-glazed ham. Yeah. Like, they all look crispy.
And I feel like as the film goes on, I have to wonder, like, are they just getting, like, sunburned? Do they film this in order? Because I feel like, Henry Fonda gets, like, darker and darker and darker as the film progresses.
They all look sunburned. Like, I heard that's why, like, in the old ones, why Clint Eastwood was always squinting. It wasn't because it looked cool. It was because he couldn't see because there was so much sunlight. But
I guess there's just more sun in Spain where they film these Westerns.
I guess so. Yeah, I think some of it was filmed in Spain and Italy, but this one's actually has some scenes in America, of all places.
Yes.
Believe it or not, you can see
it. I remember watching it, because full disclosure, I forget if I disclosed this before we started podcasting or if I'm repeating myself on the podcast. I watched this film for the very first time last night.
Right.
And I remember thinking, because it's been a little bit since I've seen any of the spaghetti westerns. Spaghetti westerns I wouldn't call like a genre that I absolutely love and like need to explore every facet of. Some people really like it. There's some great films in there. But watching this, I remember thinking, I wonder, since this is like playing up the tropes, if we're going to see anything even closely resembling Monument Valley, then literally the next scene, it's like, oh, they're going right through Monument Valley right now. How about that?
I think they said the Monument Valley scenes cost as much as like all of The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. So that's why they usually don't film in America. But the fact that it feels so kind of piecemeal, like, I mean, you were talking about the Monty Hellman Westerns the other day, which aren't spaghetti Westerns, but have like sort of a similar stripped down quality, and they're all shot in the desert, I guess, in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you made this comment.
The white sand deserts that look really alien.
Yeah, they look like another planet. Like, this almost feels like a planet. And I think, like, the fact that it has Once Upon a Time in the title, like, it feels like a more like a fairy tale land.
Yeah.
Like, it's you know, not planet, a real west. Wild West. Oh, there's Monument Valley, but it's not the Monument Valley here on Earth.
I find it very interesting that this is a time period of American history that is romanticized, especially when it's pictured like this, because, like, typical, like, 50s Hollywood Westerns, they make it look great. It looks amazing. Everyone's clean cut. Everyone's wearing, like, non-dirty clothes. And here, everything is grungy and gritty and terrible, yet it still feels romanticized.
Yeah.
I just find it very interesting how we take these time periods that probably no rational human being would ever want to live in, like Victorian era or the Middle Ages, where you would die instantly the second you get there, and turn it into these great epics.
The fact that it's coming from Europe, mostly, like, you know, it's a European filmmaker, like, it does have sort of a different romanticized quality than maybe some of the American ones do, like, the aspects that are romanticized. Like, there were European Westerns that precede the spaghetti Westerns, like, you have the Carl May Vinnetou films, and before that they were popular novels. Like, you know, there's always going to be aspects of the West that I think appealed to people who never lived there, but it's interesting, like, going all the way back, like, you had fiction being written about, like, Billy the Kid while he was still alive. Like, I always think that was really strange. Or, you know, you had figures like Jesse James who were romanticized, like, in their own lifetime. You know, so it's like this long romance with the West, but it kind of keeps changing on film. And I don't know where it's at right now when you see the odd Western
kind of... I don't know when it fell out of fashion. I don't know if it's the kind of thing where we're... And I can only speak to the American pop culture, because I know that, like, by the 70s, we were kind of done with it. The 60s were filled with TV shows, with movies. And the movies stopped getting made because it was just TV shows at that point. And people were like, why should I go out to the movies to see a Western when I can just turn on the TV and watch Rawhide or Gunsmoke or something?
Right. And those cheap TV actors went off to Europe because they were affordable and redefined the Western. So, like, it's kind of funny when you look at, like, the American Westerns that were being made kind of right at this time towards the end. Like, they were being influenced by what was being done in Europe. You had, like, I think, like, Hang 'Em High was, like, an American film, but it was specifically done to feel like these spaghetti Westerns. And you had, like, other American Westerns that were clearly influenced by it. And not just Westerns, but, like, so many films you see that Leone style trickle into, and, you know, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly's been paid homage to so many times.
I would say that its influence is probably seen before the thing itself. It's part of, like, the American subconscious now. We've all kind of just got it through osmosis, through the zeitgeist.
How do you think, like, the influence of Once Upon a Time in the West compares to... I know you've just seen it, but, like, did it feel familiar to you as much as, like, the influence of The Good, the Bad, the Ugly? Or, like, do you think this one feels a little bit like it had less of an impact?
I mean I know that it was not a box office hit in America, mostly because Paramount decided to, like, hack it up in the editing room. This felt more like a refined attempt at The Good and the Bad and the Ugly. So I definitely see this less in pop culture today than I do Good and the Bad and the Ugly. And that's probably partly why I have not exactly avoided it, but, like, I feel like, and this is just me from my own personal experience, being, like, a young movie fan in, like, high school, it's like, oh, these movies are supposed to be great because they're on the IMDb top whatever list. I'll watch them. But then you get to Once Upon a Time in the West, and you're just like, oh, it's long. I don't care.
Sure. I mean, that was kind of the experience I had when I first saw it, like, coming off of those Leone Westerns, like the Good, the Bad, the Ugly, Fistful of Dollars, Few Dollars More. And then watching this one, like, I had almost this exact same kind of, like, reaction this time watching, where, like, I'm so into it for maybe the first 12 minutes, and then it's kind of like, oh. And then, you know, another 12 minutes, I'm like, oh, this is great. And then, like, another little, like, oh. And then, like, I find those kind of, like, pile on each other after a while. And, like, I don't quite get that with The Good, the Bad, the Ugly. Like, it feels a little bit more simple. You know, it's like three guys, they're after gold, there's a war going on, that's all you need to know. Like this one, even though you can say like in certain ways it's stripped down, like there's a little bit more convolution, there's a little bit more like by going just a little bit bigger, I find like it starts to have little cracks, you know, it's spread just like a little bit too thin sometimes, the style. But that's just my reaction, and clearly I'm wrong because this is on the Sight and Sound list and The Good, the Men, the Ugly is. So
well, Martin, yeah. You're just wrong. Your opinion's yep. just wrong.
I'm just wrong. I mean, yeah. The list proves it. That's I mean, there is like a little like it does set off like some kind of like film snob alarm in my head when I see like oh, they didn't vote for the one with Clint Eastwood that we all like know and love. They voted for the other one because they know better. Like that's, you know, what I think when I saw that it was on the list, like oh, like some critic thinks like, oh, actually his best one's actually this one. So like I think I'm maybe coming at it with like a little bit of a grudge already.
But I'm gonna give them the benefit of the doubt because I know that this one was a lot more popular in Europe.
Right.
In Europe this was like huge. So mm-hmm. maybe these are just people like this is the one that they grew up with.
I mean, there were so many spaghetti westerns being made. I don't think any of them feel like they're on this scale.
Well, how many other spaghetti westerns did have American money funneled into them?
Not many. Like,
yeah, I think it's probably just like the Man with No Name trilogy, and probably not even the first one because Sergio Leone was just like, oh, let's just remake yeah. Yojimbo and not ask permission.
It's kind of interesting too, like Once Upon a Time in the West, it feels like a little bit more reverent of the classic Hollywood Westerns too. Like there's a lot of little homages. I think like on the Wikipedia, there is even like a little list like, oh, did you know, like it references Comancheros and the Searchers. And like there was like a little breakdown, but like it does feel like a little bit more like a love yeah. letter.
Well, did you read the how the story itself came about? And this can introduce a topic that I think we're both excited to mention. Who wrote the story for this? Because it's the craziest thing in the world when if you don't know this going in to see that the story is a collaboration between Dario Argento, Bernardo Bertolucci, and Sergio Leone, who are like the right. three.
Just seeing those names, you're like, oh my god.
Like, how did these three people come together to do this? Because apparently Argento
and Bertolucci
were... They're
all great, and they're all so different.
Yeah. Well, Argento and Bertolucci were critics at the time. And Sergio Leone was just like, I'm done with Westerns. I did my thing. I want to move on, make other movies. And Paramount said, no, we're giving you money to do this, so you better do this. So we hired Argento and Bertolucci to be like, watch a whole bunch of Westerns and give me a good plot. So they... that's probably why there's so many homages, because literally they just sat down, like, marathoned a bunch of... old Hollywood Westerns, and this was kind of that amalgamation that they created. And I'm not quite sure how that like Chinatown plot got into this, because it does have like a Chinatown convoluted plot.
Yeah, it does. Like, it does feel surprisingly convoluted, like for like really when you say what the story is, like mm-hmm. I'm still not even sure like what the whole deal with the train is. I've watched this film more than once and it like it eludes me to some degree, but like it's almost like you fed a computer like a bunch of Westerns and it like spat out a screenplay. Like they almost had that approach, it seems like. Argento and Bertolucci and Leone, like we'll just watch this and like amalgamate some kind of script. And like I think that does give it this quality of feeling like the Western, the Once Upon a Time in the Wild West, you know, sort of story.
Yeah.
I'm curious like what they might have taken away from this Argento and Bertolucci. I mean, like Bertolucci, like some of his films have that like huge sense of scale, like the Last Emperor, and Argento, like his sense of style, like it's not spaghetti western like, but like he's famous for his like really stylized approach to mostly the horror films. But
oh yeah, I think you can kind of see a little bit of where his style could come in this, because there's some shots that just kind of feel like they have that Argento style just without the Goblin soundtrack. Like just shots of like...
Right, those like smash cuts to close-ups.
And someone just walks into a frame and they freeze. I'm like, oh, that looks like the opening shot of Deep Red or something like that.
That's true.
So I do think that there's kind of a learn... not maybe not learn, but I think there's a common thread of style kind of going through there.
But like I think like there is sort of an Italian style. Like I don't know, like, to what extent it can if came as a reaction, like, going back to the neorealist stuff, where, like, that was meant to be, like, I mean, that is a style of neorealism, but, like, it's meant to be very, like, stripped down. And I know Leone got started as a, I think he was, like, a production assistant or camera assistant on Bicycle Thieves.
Yeah, he worked on that to some capacity. I literally had that information up, like, 2 seconds ago on my iPad and clicked away.
You know, you can almost see, like, why people coming out of that would want to do something, like, sort of in the opposite direction, where it's very sort of high style, high fantasy kind of version of reality. Like, it's not interested in the realism, really. It's interested in, like, guys who can take a bullet and shrug it off, right?
Yeah. Charles Bronson doesn't even treat that thing when he gets shot at the beginning. It's just like, oh, you got a thing there. Look at that. Yeah, whatever.
I like when Robart sees it, he's like, oh, like, I can count to six, maybe quicker than you can. And, like, oh, you're such a wimp. You got shot. Like, oh, I like that it's Woody Strode that gets the one shot off at him because he has, like, the guest star credit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, like, sometimes the credits for these spaghetti westerns are so cool where it's like, oh, like, special guest star, this person, and they're in one scene. I'm like, oh, I guess they were the special guest star. But
I always think that's the weirdest credit to have in a movie, special guest star. Like, it's a recurring thing and they got him for just this one episode. But like, yeah, you said, it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, I don't know if it's because, like, they were watching shows like Rawhide, and that's partly, like, where they got the idea of, like, how a western should be from, is watching some of the TV, not just the films. But
maybe
that's a weird credit. Those three guys, I read one of them killed himself while they were filming. He jumped out of a building. The Canadian actor, he's like the one, he's also in that, like, close-up shot in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where he's got, like, a really, like, scruffy face. They said while they were filming, I guess
that's basically everyone in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That's right, the least descriptive thing you can say for a character in a Sergio Leone film.
He's like the thinner guy, the not the one who's putting the gun on the fly. The other guy, I guess apparently he was like a drug addict and he couldn't get drugs where they were because it was really isolated. So he threw himself out,
he was
of
in
a,
the middle of Spain,
out of the top of a building in his duster. And apparently while they were driving him off in the ambulance, like, Leone was shouting, like, no, get the costume. We're going to need the costume.
Oh my God.
So I thought that was pretty dark.
That's incredibly dark.
I don't know.
Oh my God.
Also, like, on a production of this scale where it's like, you know, that there's so many extras and all this stuff, that the fact that you would, like, no, we can't afford to lose that costume, I think says something.
I mean, this movie was made for, like, what, like, 5 million tops?
I mean, it's a lot for a spaghetti western, but for, like, Hollywood films, even then, like, it's not huge.
No.
I don't know. What do you think of its, like, sense of scale, like, the train? Like, one of my favorite set pieces is what Robards is, like, on top of the train, and, like, he sticks the boot down, but he's got his hand with a gun inside of it and shoots somebody and, like, jumps on the toilet.
I don't know,
flush mechanism that springs him up.
I don't know how he was able to get an accurate shot holding a gun in a boot where he can't even see what's going on.
It's,
but it works so
don't
well.
Think about
you
it,
don't
Dave.
Question it at the time.
Don't think too hard. It's a great reveal.
Well, can we just talk about the set piece of the fact that, like, the villain of the movie has a secret lair that is a train that must be just, like, constantly circling this town?
I know. And, like, he can't walk, really, because he's sickly. So, like, he's, like, half train, half machine, half human. And his name's Morton, and he made a mistake, just like Bob Morton in RoboCop. So, well, maybe there's a...
There is clearly a connection there.
No,
but no, I just thought it was so, because, and we need to talk about his motivation. He wants to continue his railroad because he's seen the Atlantic Ocean and he wants to see the Pacific Ocean before he dies.
Right.
That is the entire reason that this entire plot is happening.
He just dies in a puddle.
I think that's very fitting because he just wanted to see an ocean. Yeah. And instead he sees a puddle.
I mean, like, the whole thing of, okay, so here we can unravel this. Claudia Cardinale, she was going to be married to...
Bill McCabe?
Or I guess she was married to McBain,
that's right.
The redheaded gentleman who, I guess, like, already had a family from, like, a previous marriage. And, like, he bought up this plot of land and all this wood where he knew the train would have to go through. So he was going to have the train station. But then Fonda kills that family.
Because he was hired to.
And I guess somehow they knew that Claudia Cardinale was married to him. So, like, they were trying to force her to sell that. Because there was, like, a clause that if they couldn't build it, then They would have to sell.
Well, she was like a wrinkle in the plan.
Right.
Because they didn't know that she was coming. They didn't know that she was already married. So then they had to, the whole reason that their plan didn't go off quite the way they wanted to is they had to get to her now because she owns that land.
Okay. I thought somehow they knew, and that's why they were like pushing her. But, and then there's like something with the, like the guys with the dusters, like dressing up to pretend to be like Robards men.
Yeah. Which is weird because they didn't leave witnesses.
Right. What? I guess somebody must have seen them somewhere.
I guess so.
And then Robards, doesn't he like, there's like a whole chase sequence that he describes that's off screen, right?
Yes. Oh, there's a couple things that happen off screen, including when they kill Morton. Spoiler alert.
I kind of like that though. Like that sort of makes it feel like, okay, that stuff's not important.
Mm-hmm.
What you're watching is the important part. The guy, you know, sitting around waiting. That's the important part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and like it does kind of give you this feeling that like the Wild West was about waiting for the train to arrive, waiting for the train to be built. You know,
mm-hmm.
It's all about waiting for revenge, waiting for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the time comes, you better be fast on the draw.
Yeah, it's actually a really astute point.
Yeah,
I like that.
I like that.
Yeah, it's all about waiting and being quick where it counts.
But I don't know. I like sometimes there's like a little bit trick photography in there, obviously, but like they're so cool. The dueling stuff is so cool.
Can we just talk about the sound effects for the guns? Because every time anyone fires a gun of any size,
yes,
it sounds like they're firing off like a nuclear missile.
Yeah. Like, oh my God. I love that
your whole
sound
room.
Effect and the sound design. It like something about it, like it's so ingrained in my mind that, I don't know if you saw, they did like a new version of The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, where they inserted like a bunch of old scenes that don't need to be in there and redid
what?
The soundtrack to make it. Yeah, like that's the version that's like easier to find now. They call it like the extended cut or director's cut or something.
Oh,
but
really?
It's like, because they didn't have English soundtracks, they had Clint Eastwood and like really old Eli Walsh do voices, but they're like, you can hear how much older they are for like some of these scenes doing the voices, and like it doesn't match up.
I wonder if that's the version I've seen.
Maybe. And like it's kind of boring because like it just messes up the pace of the film, which I think was like perfect before. But originally, mm-hmm. like all the sound effects, the gun sound effects sounded like they did in Once Upon a Time in the West, the ba-ching! But like they redid the soundtrack to make it like I think the original soundtrack might have been in mono, so they redid it, but they like changed the gun sound effects and they made them like accurate, which somehow like ruined it for me. So it's like a proper like when Clint Eastwood shoots, I'm like,
this isn't
no,
supposed to be accurate.
You broke the movie. No, like I don't know, like, and they redid the color grade, so it's like all yellowy. Like I can't watch the new Blu-ray like at all. Like I have to stick to the old DVD because it's like like something about it's like on multiple levels, like it's just not the film that I'm used to seeing.
I'm curious because didn't Kino put out those movies recently in like 4K remasters or something?
Those might be different. I think like the older Blu-ray from like a couple of years ago when they did like the remaster.
Mm-hmm.
But the sound effects here are great. especially I love in the opening scene, it sort of becomes like a music concrete kind of thing. I think Ennio Morricone even had like a hand in the sound design because like there is something really musical with the ticket taker thing spitting out sounds, and there's like a fly buzzing, and there's the water dropping on Woody Strode's hat. Like mm-hmm. it has sort of a musical rhythmic quality.
Oh yeah, no, I can definitely see that's being worked in to some degree, because clearly it's playing. Number one, the music's great, and yep. it works into the plot so well. Like even like Charles Bronson's character, mm-hmm. Harmonica,
he's all about the music.
Yeah, and like when he's playing, you may not even see his character, but you just hear that little theme go, and you know that he's around. That's just a great character element and a musical element.
Ennio Morricone, like, I think, like, not even just in film, I think he's, like, maybe one of the greatest living composers.
Oh, definitely.
I don't know, the music's so great in this film, like, how you'll hear, like, an extension of the music, like, when you have the big flashback towards the end where it reveals why Charles Bronson's out to kill Fonda, like, the music suddenly, like, it goes, like, one step beyond the theme, and it builds on it, and it's, like, you know it's the big moment, but you also mm-hmm. know it's the big moment for that character just by hearing it, because they never even say it out loud, it's just told visually.
It's a pretty messed up death scene, because he was going to hang the brother, and made Charles Bronson stand under him, and forced a harmonica in his mouth. Mm-hmm. Knowing that he wasn't going to be able to support his brother's weight for too long.
So when he drops, his brother hangs. So, like, And I kind of like, even after he shoots Fonda, Fonda still doesn't know who he is or why. Like, only when he puts the harmonica in the mouth, he gets that moment of sweet revenge, mm-hmm. knowing that Fonda finally recognized him. But the fact that the Fonda character, like, he comes across so bad that, like, he wouldn't know who would be out for revenge against him, because there must be so many people.
You know? I want him to be like, I've done this harmonica thing like 17 guys. Which one were you?
You're going to have to be more specific.
It's just like his thing.
I don't. Do you have any favorite scenes or moments in the film?
I mean, that's a pretty good one. I think we've talked about a lot of the really good ones, because I really like, and I think the Jason Robards character, Cheyenne, he's weird because you don't quite know where his loyalties stand. I think when he first comes in, mm-hmm. that's one of those really great scenes, because you have this just conflict between him and Charles Bronson for no other reason than they're just two tough guys in the West in a bar.
Right.
He's like, oh, can you play? And he's like throwing him the gun. That's just a great scene full of tension. You don't know where it's going to go.
No. Okay, I'll flip it around. Are there any scenes you didn't like or moments that you thought could have been better?
I'll say the auction scene seemed a bit slow. I feel like it came in at a point where it's just like, wait, what's going on? I thought they needed this land. Now she's auctioning it off. I feel like that's where the convolution yep. kind of comes to like a head, because you don't know what any of the characters' plans are anymore.
And then it cuts to Morton on the train, and then it cuts back, and that scene's still going, which I think gives it the feeling like where it's going on forever. Why would it end? Mm-hmm. It's kind of weird that Bronson comes in and he throws down a bid, and it's like supposed to be this big moment, but like you're not really sure what's going on.
It took me a second. The reason that it's a big moment is because he turned Cheyenne in for the reward on Cheyenne and is using the reward money
to
buy the land. And that took me like a second to get. It's like, well, why is that big? Oh, they're taking him away in handcuffs. That's why.
Mm-hmm. Who would have guessed?
But I feel like that scene could have been avoided with Claudia Cardinale just saying like, oh, I'm not going to sell it.
Yeah.
I feel like they're just still back in the same boat now where, yeah, she sold it to someone else. They could still do terrible things to her in repercussion for that.
You don't sell the dream of a lifetime. So, Dave, Once Upon a Time in the West, it's at the 78th spot on the Sight and Sound list. Do you think that's about right or fair or...
I don't know. I think it's good. Maybe not that good. I can see it being on the list, just maybe not quite that high up.
I'm still team Good, the Bad, the Ugly. That's my... Or even, like, Fistful of Dollars.
I think I might like this more than those, yeah. But, again, I haven't seen those since high school. And it's, like, a long, long time ago. Mm-hmm. So I need to give them another shot. But where I am in my life right now, I thought this was a very good movie. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't put it in my top 100 films ever made.
Okay.
I probably wouldn't even put it in my top 200, but maybe it would sneak in the top 250 near the bottom.
Okay. That sounds good.
Yeah.
And do you think it's important to have Spaghetti Western on the list?
Like, yeah, I think it's important to represent. Yeah, this part of film history. I think it makes sense that it's represented. So within that, I'm not like up in arms. I'm not going to start like taking a pitchfork to Sight and Sound.
Italians make the best Westerns.
Well, how many Westerns are above this? That is a good question.
Yeah, Searchers was up high. There weren't that many, I thought, actually, like for something that seems so much a part of film history.
I think of all genres in film history, Westerns have aged the worst, though.
And what do you think that is?
I think there's a couple elements. I think with Westerns, you're going to have a lot of like complicated race things, especially with like Native Americans. That's always a bit... Mm-hmm. Even you watch The Searchers and it's like, ooh, this makes me feel uncomfortable. But I think that it just... That genre itself just became so... And probably the Spaghetti Westerns helped kind of make them seem naive, because the Spaghetti Westerns are so gritty and they kind of change the way Westerns are, and it was hard to go back. And then you look back after you have something like Once Upon a Time in the West, you go back and watch My Darling Clementine, and even though it's a really good movie, for a while it's going to seem...
What do you mean the good guy won't shoot first? What's yeah. going on here?
Yeah, it's going to feel a bit hokey. Mm-hmm. And they feel like you can't undo that.
That's true. And like we did go through, like I think in the 90s, like there was a sort of a couple of these like bigger sort of revisionist westerns or anti-westerns. You had like Unforgiven, you had Dead Man, like that kind of, in some ways, make it hard to go back to the classic westerns. And
yeah,
I think like maybe part of the reason why The Searchers is so high on the list is because that kind of feels like a very early, I don't know, revisionist western or anti-western. Like, it's very cynical for John Ford western. That's part of the reason why it's still fashionable. Although, like, from what I hear, like, Ford is kind of falling out of fashion, maybe, which, I mean, that's a little too bad, but
yeah. He made so many westerns, though, and
yeah.
I think The Searchers, of all his westerns, is worthy of kind of that of a high spot. Stagecoach, I think, would be worth a high spot. I really like the Howard Hawks westerns that I've seen. Rio Bravo and Red River, they're both great. They're both complex, which I think is interesting. I think it's the complex ones that are standing the test of time.
I think Red River is on the Sight and Sound list.
That wouldn't surprise me. Oh, Rio Bravo is above this.
But yeah, no, it's cool to have at least one Italian one on the list. And yeah. I think last time we did like a FlixWise proper episode together, we did The Leopard, right?
Well, you know what, Martin? I hope that we can talk about more Italian movies. Maybe we can talk about all of Lucia Fulci's entries in the Sight and Sound top 250 list.
There should be all of them in there. There should be 250 Lucio Fulci movies.
Yes, even though he only made not that many, but there could be a couple. Some can be on there twice.
If you had like Lucio Fulci, Bava, Argento, that would take up the whole Sight and Sound list.
Yeah, well, Argento has stuff on the Sight and Sound list. Doesn't he?
Does he?
I think he does. I think Deep Red might be in the top 250.
No. I would have freaked out if I saw that.
I could have sworn that he was on this.
You know, his writer credit here, it's not, like, unreasonable for him to be on, but I thought, like, if I'd seen a Dario Argento film, I would have flipped. Anyway, so, do you want to talk final note of positivity, or?
Oh, my goodness. I need to be positive about something. You know what? I know what I can be positive about. I watched Stranger Things 2 recently. I've seen a lot of mixed reactions on the internet, but you know what? I thought it was great. I really liked it. I like that show.
Okay. I'm five episodes in. I'm enjoying it so far.
Yeah. The new season moves, like, really fast. I feel like that's the one thing I can say against the second season that the first season did better. And probably because you're getting to know these characters for the first time, even though it's like actually one episode less, it feels like more things happen because all the pieces need to come together. And in this, the pieces are already together. It's just the puzzle is shifting slightly.
Okay. I like that. That's my final note of positivity too. We'll have the same one.
We both did Stranger Things too. Did I literally steal your thunder?
No, that works. That's good. I'm okay with that. Folks want to follow the show, it's on iTunes, it's on all quality places where podcasts are held, I guess. Check out the Facebook page, check out the Twitter at FlixWise, and the website, of course, is FlixWise.com. And Dave, where can folks find you on the internet?
I can be found on the internet, primarily on Twitter, where I spend most of my time. I'm on Twitter at Cinema Versus Dave. That is Cinema VS Dave.
Fantastic. And until next time, listeners, I'll be riding off into the sun, and Lady P should be back to host, so you can look forward to that. Take care.